Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It is a pleasure for me to welcome you all to this event on the geopolitical implications of the Israel-US-Iran war, hosted by the Middle East Center at LSE. My name is Caterina Dalla Cora. I'm the director of the Middle East Center and a member of the International Relations Department here at LSE. So we have an hour and a half at our disposal, and it will be evenly split between presentations by our speakers and Q&A with the audience. We will be taking photographs during the event, and it will be recorded, but there's no live streaming. We're not expecting a fire drill. If a fire alarm sounds, please take the stairs and proceed to the nearest assembly point, which is Sheffield Street, outside the Saw Suisse Hock Student Centre. So let me say a few words that will frame the discussion and introduce the speakers. Now, this is a bit ironic, but I thought I would try to sort of be a bit provocative and start with a comment on the discipline of international relations. The comment is that the discipline of international relations, not the subject but the study of it, is currently experiencing an existential threat, a victim of its own success in widening its remit. But unfortunately, current developments in world politics remind us that if IR did not exist, it would have to be invented. The discipline of international relations was forged in fire, literally, in that its root concern was war. To explain it, but also more importantly, to mitigate it. Now, this evening, we will ask ourselves about the former, about explanation, rather than mitigation. The former explanation is more than enough for our allotted time. Now, of course, wars have never subsided in world politics. But what is unique in the present moment is the threat of war spreading from the Middle East to engulf large parts of the globe. Russia, China, and India are presently in the periphery of the conflict, but this could very well change, for instance, by Middle Eastern war becoming interlinked with the Ukraine war in Europe. And the Israel-US-Iran war is already global in an economic sense, because of Iran's blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, sending oil and gas prices into a spiral. We could have included the term geoeconomics in the title of our event, as well as geopolitics. We could also have included the term balance of power, a flawed and slippery, yet indispensable and unavoidable concept in historical moments such as the one we're living through now. The start of the war, I would suggest, was the product of the failure of the balance of power, with one side, US and Israel, becoming undeterrable, too strong to be deterred. Israel, with motives that are always the subject of ideological contestation, is flexing its muscles across the region. Balance of power also holds the key to how the war has unfolded. The trial run of June 2025, I would suggest, showed Iran that it cannot win a direct military confrontation with Israel and the US. And as a result, it determined on a twin strategy, broadening the war by attacking the GCC and holding the international economy hostage through the Strait of Hormuz. Now, with us to explore the implications of the current crisis is a distinguished panel of international relations experts. I will introduce them and say just briefly what they will talk about, and then I will open to them. So Toby Dodge is Professor of International Relations in the Department of IR here at LSE. His research concentrates on the evolution of the post-colonial state in the international system. The main focus of this war on the developing world is the state in the Middle East, and specifically Iraq. Toby will look at medium-term regional security dynamics with a greatly weakened Iran, a militarily empowered and probably dominant Israel, unambiguously backed by the United States. He will also talk about the Gulf states and specifically the UAE. Dr. Salam Vakil is the director of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Her expertise spans Iranian and Gulf politics, regional security dynamics, and US foreign policy. She has a particular focus on the evolving strategic landscape of the Middle East and its global connectivity. Salam will discuss how widely the war may become entrenched across the region beyond the first tactical phase, affecting the domestic politics of its key players, specifically Iran. She will talk about how the war will reshape regional power balances, alliances, and security structures across the region. She will touch on the Gulf, US, and Israel. Last but not least, Peter Tubovits is Professor of International Relations, again here at LSE, and Director of the Fallon US Center here at LSE. He's Associate Fellow at Chatham House. His main teaching and research interests are in the fields of international security and US foreign policy, and he also writes and comments frequently on US politics. Peter's analysis will center on the war's impact on theaters of conflict in Europe and Asia. He will delve into the way the war may affect an international order already in flux. So each of our speakers will talk for about 10 minutes, and then we're going to have the Q&A. I myself would be very happy to answer questions on Turkey, on which I have done some work, in the Q&A, but I will not do a formal presentation. So please, let us welcome our speakers. So Toby, you go first. Would you like to come up?
Oh, no, I'll continue to sit. Thanks. Well, it's a pleasure to be here this evening. Thank you for everyone for turning out. And I share with Peter Sanam and Katerina the platform with, you know, three superb experts who know a great deal more than me. And then I look across the audience and there's a weight of expertise in the audience. And we've all been madly doom-scrolling, I do believe it's called, trying to understand since the 28th of February what's been going on. And I'm not sure I know a lot more than you do. So what I'm going to indulge in is the very dangerous speculation of futurology. So I could get this horribly wrong, and I feel free to ridicule me next time you meet me. So I want to look at maybe three things. Firstly, just what we do know, or what I think is important about what we know, and that leads to possible short-term impacts. Then onto the much thinner empirical ice of long-term impacts of what we might call global in the regional security complex. And then finally, the political strategy or lack of it, I think, as Peter may say, with the US. And then what I've called rather fancily, and my students would be used to this, is the kind of strategic ontology of what may dominate the region, the regional security complex of the Gulf and the wider Middle East in the aftermath of this. So firstly, we're 18 days in, if my counting earlier on tonight is right, from the beginning of this completely unprovoked attack on Iran on the 28th of February. There's an awful lot that's unknown, but there are a few things that are, I think, clear at the moment, and it's from this that I'll start thinking about what we might speculate. Firstly, US and Israeli air power is dominant. I think it's 13,000 strikes in the past 2 weeks, a huge amount of innocent civilians killed. Political strategy, US political strategy, to put it mildly, it's not clear. It's not clear what they want, or it changes with every press conference and Truth Social tweet that Trump engages in, and it's not clear how they're going to achieve what they don't know what they want. Then we have Iranian resistance, which at the moment, and I think Sanam may talk to this, has largely focused on drone attacks and a widening strategy that has been flagged up and discussed as long as I've been working on the Gulf. So the Straits of Hormuz, the threatening of oil flows and the attacking on tankers has been a kind of staple in Gulf discussions. Quite why the Pentagon hadn't got a plan to deal with it is another matter. We also know the axis of resistance since the June war has been hammered and greatly weakened. The drone attacks have hit the UAE especially, the majority of drones as far as I understand it, but also Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and to an intriguingly lesser extent, Saudi Arabia. As I said, ballistic missiles haven't been deployed yet. The optimists amongst the commentariat suggest that that's because they've been hit by Israeli and US air power. Pessimists would say that there may be room for escalation. And then we have Israel in a novel, overt alliance with the United States, not only attacking the Iran, but also Lebanon, and since the June war, making this general noise of conflict a shield behind which they're getting on with the war against the Palestinians in Gaza and cementing their control on the West Bank. So what are the medium-term reports of this, outcomes of this? Well, firstly, I think a greatly weakened Iran. Even if Iran continues to mount resistance, continues to undermine the flow of oil through the Straits of Hormuz, its deterrence strategy, the mosaic strategy, this layered defence, has clearly failed because they're being heavily attacked. They've lost wave upon wave of their senior leadership. Secondly, the Gulf Cooperation states, especially the United Arab Emirates and specifically Dubai, have been greatly weakened. The somewhat cliched stories of tax-free expats fleeing Dubai for elsewhere is indicative, I think, obviously, of your great sympathy, but also of the insecurity of a state that's a small state that sits clearly at the heart of the region. And finally, I think the air power that I've touched upon indicates that we may move on to a strategic hegemony for Israel going forward in partnership, continued overt partnership as long as the Trump presidency lasts, with the United States, but also, what's possibly surprising or not, is that the relationship with the United Arab Emirates has persevered after October the 7th through the war against Gaza and onwards. Now, I want to talk about two big political issues. Firstly, political strategy. Now, the term political strategy came to me in the aftermath of the Iraq's descent into civil war and the United States military attempt to drag the United States out of what was then flagged up before the withdrawal of Afghanistan from Afghanistan as one of the greatest defeats since the Vietnam War. Now, the political strategy is clearly an attempt to realize that military dominance on its own cannot achieve sustainable political results. And so you then have to ask, okay, so this military air superiority by Israel and by the United States, what is it actually for? And as we see in the Washington Post on the 7th of March, the Washington Post will be decimated by cuts and layoffs, it still seems to be the first point of call for strategic leaking from Washington, from the Beltway. So the National Intelligence Council report that was drafted, I think, in mid-February, says that within whatever of the two major scenarios that they were working with, this collective output of the American intelligence services, a regime collapse was unlikely in Iran. So if, and it's a big if, the Trump administration was listening to its own intelligence services, it shouldn't have been counting on a collapse of the regime. In fact, the National Intelligence Council in Washington suggested it would lead to an entrenchment of the Iran's military and clerical establishment. So then what would be the political strategy of Netanyahu in Israel? Now, you could look for domestic explanations, of course. Netanyahu is still facing those corruption issues, has asked for clemency. But since October the 7th, 2023, and the attacks from Gaza into Israel, the argument has been that Israel has been trying to restore strategic deterrence. Well, I'm struggling with the means and logic behind that, especially as it's seeking to remove Kiev, certainly Hezbollah, but certainly it's weakening the regime in Syria and it's trying to weaken, if not remove, the regime in Iran. Is that strategic deterrence? I can't really see the logic behind that, which brings us to the long-term effects. And now I was rifling through the library on the 9th and 10th floor of the International Relations Department, and I came up with a book by Barry Bazan, our emeritus professor, where he's looking at regional security complexes. And it strikes me that there are three regional security complexes that we can look to when we do our futurology. The first is a complicated, a sub-regional security complex, which is basically the Gulf. Iran as a dominant power, as an aspirant hegemonic power. It's although it can make hay with oil prices pushing them up above $100 a barrel, it is no longer dominant. It will emerge, however it emerges from this conflict, it will be a militarily broken state, which then leaves, intriguingly, Israel and its ability to project power into the Gulf, the UAE, with in tension with Saudi Arabia. And it's that tension I want to look at. And what's been happening in the Gulf, in this sub-regional security complex, especially, but even before Obama's 2012 pivot to East Asia, is a greater autonomy for the United Arab Emirates, for Saudi Arabia, partly driven by a change of the guard, a new generation, partly driven by an amassing of security capacity, but also partly ambition. The United Arab Emirates, under Mohammed bin Zayed, has taken part in a series of interventions, has developed its air force, and has successfully, as far as we can see, pushed through universal male conscription. Which leads us, in my final couple of minutes, to the notion of what this regional security complex may look like with Israeli dominance, with the overt backing of the United States, but also Israeli dominance in an extended partnership with the United Arab Emirates. I think Israel, as we've seen, and again it is a question to be put on the table, has extended its military superiority to decimate, to unleash what I think is fair to describe as genocide in Gaza. It has driven settlements in the West Bank using the October the 7th as a cover, but also, and I think more intriguingly, since the fall of the Assad regime in December 2024, it's executed heavy strikes on what was remained of the Syrian Navy and the army, but it's also supported the Druze factions around Suwayda in July 2025 in the battles with the nascent new Syrian army. We moved to Lebanon, 1 million people displaced from southern Lebanon since the 2nd of March, a series of destructive strikes on Beirut that go well beyond the stated discussion, the stated aims of breaking the axis of resistance and reducing the threat from Hezbollah. And I will end, as promised, in the green room with pointing to Somaliland, which again is in the Red Sea, but was recognised by Israel. And I think we see what I would call this security ontology, where Israel is trying to guarantee its own survival by breaking the coherence, by empowering sub-state actors across the region and the region's hinterland in the Red Sea and Africa and beyond. And in that, I'll leave this with the final thought, it seems to be joined by the United Arab Emirates and its support of the rapid, and its support of one side, not the state side, in the Sudanese civil war. So I'll leave you with that. I think Iran will be broken and weakened, however much damage it unleashes on the other side of the Gulf. The regional security complex will see an empowered Israel, but an Israel with certainly the military capacity to wreak havoc, but not a political strategy to stabilize what it leaves in its wake. And President Trump, greatly reduced, I would suggest, by the November midterms, will stagger in and thank God won't get another term unless something dramatic happens in the United States. But that leaves a region fractured by this situation, but also by the overt state fragmentary policies of both the UAE and Israel. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Katerina. It's a pleasure to follow Toby, and I'm grateful to the LSE and the Middle East Center for the invitation to be with you tonight. There is a lot to talk about, and I'm going to build on Toby's comments in sort of laying out how he sees the region and how it's going to adapt in the post-war scenario to take my brief or my assignment and speak to those points at the end, but initially try to lay out how we got here, what the objectives are of the various parties, how I see the war evolving, and, you know, then maybe speak of off-ramps and what's ahead in terms of the region. So from my assessment, this war was very inevitable. Why was it inevitable? Well, for two reasons. First, since October 7th, Israel has revisited its security doctrine in the region, no longer showing tolerance or ability to manage Iran-backed groups on its borders and making clear after October 7th that it was facing a seven-fronted war. And those seven fronts at this point should be abundantly clear. It's Gaza, it's the West Bank, it's Lebanon, it's Syria, it's Iraq, it's Yemen, and of course, above all, it's Iran. And so this inevitability of this war is about Iran, ultimately. Israel and Prime Minister Netanyahu has made it clear he's not interested just in degrading or decapitating Iran-backed groups in the region, the tentacles of the so-called octopus, but actually the octopus's head. So that is one driver of this war. And the second driver is actually the events of last summer, the so-called 12-day war, where as an outgrowth of overt conflict between Iran and Israel since October 7th, we saw thresholds crossed. We saw Israel strike Iran very effectively and demonstrating its military superiority. There should be no surprise there, but taking out Iran's leadership in an effective way, but also trying to degrade Iran's asymmetrical defense capabilities, with the last day of that war seeing Donald Trump wanting to venture in and also burying parts of Iran's nuclear program. Why was the war inevitable as an outcome of last summer's war? Because that war resulted in really not satisfying outcomes for any of the parties. And what do I mean by that? Israel felt like it could have done more and was forced to accept an American-imposed ceasefire. The United States, of course, recognized that it buried Iran's nuclear program, but, you know, there was no real off-ramp or deal or negotiation that successfully sort of solved or subordinated Iran out of this war. And for the Islamic Republic that survived this war, and its survival is important in this narrative, it was left very open, clearly exposed militarily, and it was clear that the status quo, with no deal, with no other off-ramp, that another war was inevitable. And so actually on the 13th day of the 12-day war, I believe that all sides started to prepare for what we saw ensue on February 28th. I think it's 18 days now. For me, it feels like 18 months. And certainly for the region, it feels that way the same. And we're here because actually this war was executed or operationalized based on a few objectives and some faulty assumptions. The objectives, of course, of the United States and Israel are important to understand, but also break apart. They're not completely unified as actors in this war. And there will be a lot of dissection of who did what and who convinced whom. Nevertheless, I think they both have responsibility. For the United States, this, as was presented on February 28th, a historic opportunity to redress a long-standing adversarial relationship for the United States. Perhaps buoyed by the Venezuela campaign, the United States and President Donald Trump was convinced that this was a historic opportunity, not necessarily to make Iran great again, but for the United States to extract meaningful concessions from a regime that had challenged the United States for 47 years, really destabilized the region for 47 years, and had been a thorn in the side of the regional security architecture. For Israel, this objective, as I explained, is very much driven by the changing posture after October 7th. And Israel's objectives were to finish the job that began in the 12-day war, not just to militarily degrade Iran, but actually to force the Islamic Republic into a retreat. Iran is seen historically in the region as being an offensive state, a state that has projected its power across the region, supported groups in multiple countries beyond its borders, and obviously directing its offensive capabilities against U.S. interests and Israeli interests. So ultimately, there are slight divergences that need to be understood. The faulty assumptions that we have to understand, though, are important here, because if you remember, 18 days ago, President Trump said this was going to be 4 to 5 days. And actually, since that 7 or 8 minute speech that he laid out U.S. objectives, we've seen a lot of shifting timelines, shifting goals, shifting goalposts. And that's because this war was prosecuted based on faulty assumptions. What are the faulty assumptions? A, that the Islamic Republic was weak, thereby after 4 to 5 days of an intensive U.S. and Israeli operation, and one that was and has been severe on Iran, that the regime was weak and would be prone to collapse. The second, of course, faulty assumption was that after 4 to 5 days, perhaps there would be an off-ramp or negotiations or actually an opportunity for internal dissent to materialize and then, of course, change the dynamics, maybe not producing revolution, but sort of Venezuela-like outcome in the context of Iran. And the third faulty assumption is obviously that this war would not produce an Iranian reaction or retaliation that we have now witnessed for the past 18 days. And so it explains that process, bureaucracy, procedure, and expertise very much matters. And you should not receive your advice at any layer or level of your life from activists, but rather from the expertise or analysts that spend time trying to analyze situations. By all accounts, Iran in January experienced very serious protests. Those protests saw a nationwide uprising that was challenging the Islamic Republic. And on January 8th, Iran went into a national blackout that it hasn't come out of. The Islamic Republic massacred a huge number of its citizens, and the statistics there are still in question. It doesn't matter how many people they killed. They killed people brutally, and that's what matters. But based on that assessment, there were assumptions about what could come next. And I think that we need to understand that this faulty planning for the known unknowns of this war have brought us into March and brought us into a number of scenarios that are really unpredictable, not just for Iran, not just for the region, but obviously for us here in Europe and the UK and more broadly. So what are the goals of the number of actors here? It's important to understand. I've explained that the United States has shifted its goals and goalposts. Certainly, there is no doubt, and I 100% concur with Toby, the Islamic Republic as we know it will not be able to emerge from this war as the Islamic Republic of February 27th. It is being degraded on a daily basis by two strong military powers, the United States and Israel. But what is the Islamic Republic's goal? It's very different from that of the United States and Israel. The Islamic Republic seeks survival. And oftentimes in Middle Eastern wars, survival is akin to a victory. And when you cannot, obviously, contest at the same level, Iran has not the same conventional military capabilities as the United States and Israel. But when you can survive an onslaught from two superior military powers, that can be sold as victory. And so that is Iran's objective. And so how is it trying to survive this onslaught? It is trying to survive in a sort of traditional way, as we have seen in past operations. Maybe Vietnam comes to my mind. North Vietnam, for example, spread the costs of its military campaign against the United States in a horizontal way. What do I mean by that? It spread the pain of the war beyond its own borders so that it impacted people more broadly, including the U.S., including other countries involved. And that is what Iran is doing. It doesn't want the pain of this war to be borne by Iranians themselves or the Islamic Republic as well, but actually you, your interest rates. It wants you to pay the price at the petrol pump. It wants the region to bear the cost of this war. And that's exactly what we are seeing play out. It is an asymmetrical war designed to play for time, play the game of attrition, to wear down and wear out stronger adversaries that cannot perhaps accept or manage a long and costly war. It's unclear if it will necessarily succeed, but for the time being, 18 days in, while it is being pummeled day in and day out, despite the fact that its leadership is being decapitated day in and day out, it is reconstituting and it is responding. And 2 minutes. And why is the Islamic Republic pursuing this strategy? because it saw the outcome of the 12-day war last summer as unacceptable. It cannot emerge from this war in the same situation as the 12-day war. It doesn't want an American-imposed ceasefire. It needs to drive and determine the outcome of this war. So what does Iran seek? It seeks an agreement that guarantees that this war will never happen again. And how can this be guaranteed? Again, a little far-fetched to imagine, but that the international community, perhaps even the UN Security Council, will guarantee that there will be no mowing of the lawn, which is the sort of terminology used to describe Israel's strategy against its adversaries in the region, that Israel can't come back in 6 months or 12 months, that the United States can't afford to prosecute another war like this. Iran also seeks sanctions relief, because ultimately the Islamic Republic has been weakened over the past year, over the past 10 years, from the prosecution of a regionally destabilizing campaign, from the investment in a nuclear program that is currently buried inside Iran. And it's only through obtaining sanctions relief that this regime, that will certainly be weakened militarily, that it can rebuild its relationship internally. I think what matters is how this war ends. And so that's what we have to look at. Right now we are in the fog of war. We're uncertain as to how long this will certainly continue. I think for Iran, it's very clear that it is not going to allow only Donald Trump to dictate the terms of this war. And that's why we are in this standoff of the Strait of Hormuz, but over like potential future escalation. So for Israel, the U.S., for the region, we're going to be watching the terms and conditions of any sort of deal making. It's a race for time. It's a sort of attrition campaign underway. The war will come to an end at some level or layer possible, but it's everything that's left behind that we have to watch. And it's the so-called day after, when we look at the Middle East, that's important as well, because it's in the day after that the Islamic Republic, or what's left of it, will face economic challenges, will face political challenges, but ultimately also confront regional challenges, because it has struck out at 12, 13 of its neighbors in order to survive this war.
Thank you so much. Peter.
Great. It's great to be with all of you tonight. I want to thank Katerina and the Middle East Center for inviting me to join Sanam and Toby in this discussion. I've already learned a lot just listening to them. Katerina asked me to talk about the geopolitical ramifications of the war beyond the region. And there are many, and the shockwaves are being felt from Asia to Europe to North America. And I think how enduring these effects are, I mean, it depends on many things, but certainly how long, one of them is just how long the war lasts. But even if I think Donald Trump woke up tomorrow and declared victory and withdrew U.S. forces, or began withdrawing U.S. forces from the region, and Iran agreed to stop attacking its neighbors and tankers traveling through the strait, I think the war's geopolitical implications would continue to reverberate for some time. And I say that if only because I think the war has revealed, and this just simply can't be, you can't unsee this, just how vulnerable the world economy is to Iran. And it has fueled serious doubts about Washington's reliability as a security provider. That's true inside the region, but it's true beyond. So the first thing I want to say flows directly from this, and it is simply that I think the war has reminded us of just how interdependent this planet is, and as a result, how vulnerable we all are to calculated efforts by states and their leaders to weaponize them. Iranian leaders plan to counter the American and Israeli attacks, U.S. and Israeli power, by weaponizing the strait, I think just reminds us that it's not only the United States and China, the big boys, that can weaponize interdependence, as both of them have, by leveraging, in the U.S. case, access to its markets, and in the Chinese case, access to its resources, particularly rare. Under the right circumstances, smaller middle powers can wreak havoc too. And this is especially true if you happen to sit astride one of the world's economies, like critical arteries. You know how to make cheap drones at scale, and you have your back against the proverbial wall. So I think outgunned what Iran decided way before the war began was that it was going to adopt one of the oldest strategies in the book, which is to widen the scope of the conflict to change the equation, in this case, to attack its Arab neighbors, who live under the U.S. security umbrella and basically hold the world economy hostage. And so it gives new meaning, I think, to this, you know, the phrase weapons of the weak, that the Trump administration is learning this along with the rest of us. Frankly, it speaks volumes. Now, whether Iran's stranglehold on Hormuz is the ultimate Trump card in the war, I think remains to be seen. But playing this card, I think just already, I mean, just right off the bat, it dashed whatever hopes Donald Trump had, I think this was operative in his mind, that he was going to have a Venezuela-style victory. And it forced Trump, of course, to try to get America's allies in Asia and Europe to provide naval vessels to help clear the strait and safely escort tankers. And this is his counter of trying to broaden the scope of the conflict in a way. The idea is not to get the European and Asian allies into the war, but it's to help them help the United States get its chestnuts out of the fire. And I think that whatever worries Japanese, South Korean, French, German leaders have about what Trump might do to them, raise tariffs. He's planning on doing that anyway. But they are, I think, they're calculating, they're balancing those costs and risks against the risk, the very real risk of getting dragged into a war that they did not welcome, that their publics think is misguided, and that, frankly, they don't have the military capacity to offer to secure the strait. So this brings me to a second point about winners and losers. All wars have them, and they're not just those in the immediate vicinity. It's early days, but I think probably we can say, if we're 18 days, I've lost count, we're 18 days in, that China and Russia are arguably the biggest winners here. At least for now. For China, I think the war offers several strategic advantages. Every U.S. missile that is fired reduces American stockpiles, and the U.S. has been firing a damn lot of missiles. Every week of economic disruption basically weakens confidence in Washington as a strategic partner. Every flashy display of U.S. military prowess gives Beijing a better fix on America's relative military strengths and weaknesses in case of war over Taiwan. The war helps Russia, too. The huge spike in the price of energy, of course, you know, amounts to a very significant win for Moscow. Meanwhile, the longer the war goes on, the fewer American missiles there will be for Europe to buy to support Kiev and its. I don't want to suggest it's all upside for Beijing and Moscow, because it's, I mean, the Middle East is a key market for Chinese goods and investment. And depending on what happens to Oman, I suppose I should say, Karg Island, the war could make China, which is still a fossil fuel guzzler, despite the ongoing switch to renewables, more reliant on Russian oil and gas than it would prefer. The bigger issue, though, is that despite its massive economic investments and deep political ties to Iran, Beijing looks to have left Tehran to its own devices. I mean, it's basically, all it's done is it's condemned America's action. But it's otherwise watched the war unfold from the sidelines. So this is twice. Venezuela first, now Iran. Moscow's been, you know, more involved. Apparently it's providing Tehran sensitive intelligence about U.S. forces in the region, but it's basically otherwise steered clear of the conflict. So what about the losers? Well, leaving aside Iran's Gulf neighbors, who along with Iran and Lebanon, I think have suffered the biggest losses from the war, I would say America's allies in Asia and Europe would be the most vulnerable if the war drags, but for different reasons. So in the case of U.S. allies in Asia, the crux of the problem is twofold. First, their very heavy dependence on Persian Gulf. And secondly, their very heavy dependence on America's security. So the dependence on the Persian Gulf energy has left basically Japan, South Korea, and others vulnerable to Iran's weaponization, and in the near term, heavily dependent on the stockpiles of oil and gas that they have. Meanwhile, they've just had to watch stony-faced as the United States has moved critical defensive missile systems out of the region to the Gulf, raising concerns about where America's true strategic priorities lie. And I think concerns about what the war means for Washington's strategic priorities are also very much on the minds of European leaders. Here, though, I don't think the primary concern is access to energy supplies. There is a problem, I think, for Europe because, I mean, since the breakout of the Ukraine war, Europe has become very heavily dependent upon American gas, liquefied gas. And given that it can never be sure about what the current U.S. president is going to do, that is a vulnerability. But the bigger risk is that the longer the war in Iran goes on and the more the Pentagon soaks up U.S. military production capacity, the less there is going to be to support the effort.
2 minutes.
And this brings me to the final point, which will take only 2 minutes, with what the war means for the United States geopolitically. And I think here the picture is mixed. On the one hand, I think the sheer display of American firepower reminds us that the multipolar world that everybody from Xi to Modi to Macron has heralded hasn't arrived. Not yet, at any rate. One doesn't have to approve what the Trump administration is doing in and to the region to appreciate or to recognize that no other country in the world can project this kind of power that far from its shores. Does that mean the United States is omnipotent? No. Even at the height of American unipolarity in the early 2000s, the failure in Iraq underscored the problem is that translating military power into desired political outcome ultimately depends on an effective strategy. And I think the war in Iran is really just driving that point home again. It's as if, though, the point was never learned. Right? And that's one possible explanation for why the Trump administration thus far hasn't been able to translate its military power into a favor. If there was a strategy initially, it doesn't seem to have factored in that the enemy gets a vote, what the enemy might do in response. Another possible explanation for the poor planning is that the Trump administration doesn't really care, that the point here is to simply break things, to signal that America can and will break things if others don't submit to its will. Venezuela was Exhibit A. Iran, perhaps, to be Exhibit B. There is, though, a third explanation, that Trump actually succeeded only too well. what he set out to do back in January 2024. Staff his key positions with individuals who don't have the experience, the wisdom, or the gravitas to say to the president, Mr. President, this is a bad idea. I'll leave it right there.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you all very much. I will open the floor straight away because we only have 35 minutes. And I will take questions in threes. I will stop you if you go on too long. Please ask a question. Don't make a statement. And please say who you are before you start speaking. There are microphones to go around. Thank you. So one question there, another question there, and the third one there. And then I'll go to the top floor.
Thank you for the discussion. My name is Hari. I'm a recent graduate from SOAS. I hope I'm audible. So my question is to Dr. Sanam Akhil. I'd like to know what the priorities are of the Gulf states, especially states like Saudi Arabia. Are they looking for immediate de-escalation given the uncertainties and the unpredictable behavior of the U.S., also keeping in mind the unrestrained behavior of Israel? Thank you.
Yes.
Hello, my name is Danya. I'm a student here at the LSE. My question is about the Iranian diaspora and the reaction of them to this whole conflict. From my point of view, it's been, quite split, quite polarizing at times, and quite confusing as well. So I was wondering if you have any reflections.
Thank you. The third question is there in the corner.
Bruce Stanley, retired academic. Where are the Houthis? And how would that strategically change the global environment? Why aren't they involved?
Thank you. So who wants to go on what?
I just want to make sure I know, where are the goodies?
Yes.
The Houthis.
The Houthis. Okay.
Okay.
I thought you were referring to enriched uranium.
Should I start?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Yes.
So quickly on the Gulf states, I mean, obviously this war has really exposed the Gulf strategy to manage Iran through diplomacy. There's been various efforts at normalization from the Gulf side towards Iran and vice versa, but also towards Israel. And, you know, it's important to remember that going into this war, the Gulf states collectively and individually lobbied the Trump administration to support diplomatic off-ramps. And despite reporting, and there's a lot of misinformation in this war, so I would really caution you to read multiple sources of formal news, not just what you find on social media. The Gulf states wholly, including Saudi Arabia, oppose this war. So where does this leave them? It leaves them very vulnerable because their traditional ally, the United States, thought about Israel more than it thought about them. Secondly, of course, the Gulf states are very worried that at the end of this war, they will be left holding the reality of their geography of a vulnerable, weakened, wounded, but still potentially destabilized Iran. So, you know, what are they trying to achieve? They would like to see the end of this war, but at the same time recognize that there are limitations in how to end this war. You know, they're kind of wide open. They're taking down missiles and drones. They're doing the best that they can, but it is not a war that they can end on their own. So the longer-term tail has to be examined. On the diaspora, very quickly, yes. I mean, in the same way that we can't speak for 92 million Iranians, I certainly can't speak for a diaspora that is wholly divided and very fragmented. I certainly wouldn't turn to the diaspora, and this is going to be controversial, to determine what's going to come next in Iran. I think that the future of Iran should be determined by the people inside the country that have been held hostage by a brutal regime. And the diaspora is very fragmented, certainly not ready for this war, and very much trying to take advantage of this war. And it's causing, I think, ripple effects inside Iran, where people are frustrated, hoping that this war might produce a better outcome, clearly also aware that this war isn't going to leave them in a better place. So I would try to find voices of people inside the country that, you know, reflect a variety of views. Again, 2 million people, and diaspora that is wholly divided and very toxic isn't going to animate those perspectives, perhaps in the way that they should.
I think all the Gulf states, they remember very much Trump's first term and the hubristic indulging in Iran baiting. And the costs both Saudi and the Emirates had very quickly to pay. A couple of, if I remember correctly, one of the world's largest oil refineries hit by drones and a couple of tankers off Sharjah. And then there was a lot of backtracking with the United States doing little or nothing to reestablish deterrence where Iran was concerned. I think Salah's point about what the Saudis are doing, I think, is intriguing. So the Financial Times, I think, today had a big piece about saying the Saudis were pulling their hair out and very worried, as you imagine they would be. They've been hit comparatively lightly at this stage compared to the Emirates. So I think that's a statement of intent, not accident, by Iran. But of course, it's not only internet reporting. There's some fairly well-sourced reporting, I think, from the New York Times suggesting otherwise. Now, I don't think any of us can make the call, but I think if we look at what Peter was doing at the end, if we look at the consequences, especially for Dubai and the United Arab Emirates' sustained attempt to become a global financial hub, a global logistics hub, that has clearly taken a damage. So I would be very surprised, given what happened in Trump 1 and the damage already done in this war, whether either of the majority of the Gulf states had in any way encouraged it. But that brings us, as Bruce says, to the Houthis. And I think if we look at the axis of resistance, each have had to have, you know, it's often said the axis of resistance is made up of Iranian proxies, and I'm always deeply uneasy about the term proxy, because clearly even the most directly connected militia players in Iraq have their own domestic constituencies. They take Iranian money, training and support, but they act on their own logics, and I think that's exactly what the Houthis are doing at the moment, given the consequences. Now, of course, you may not want the war to come to you, but it may come looking to find you, and that's exactly what the United States did last night when it took out the head of the Hezbollah brigades in Baghdad, and the response has been swift and chaotic, the embassy being hit and stuff. So I think that there is a dynamic that broadens out the regional conflagration in spite of restraint, and I suspect that will eventually come to Yemen, either through the Israelis taking advantage or the Houthis lashing back. So they're there, the Houthis, and I suspect that they will get involved. But I think also, if you look at the example I mentioned of the targeting in Baghdad yesterday, the United States clearly have much larger war aims and are, I think, mowing the grass further afield than Tehran. Now, whether that's strategic or tactically, that they're responding to targets of opportunity, which we're told the Supreme Leader's death may have well triggered the start of the conflict early because of intelligence. That again indicates the lack of a strategy and more of an opportunist.
Thank you. Peter?
I'll pick up on the Houthis. I'll go down that path. I mean, one theory that's out there is that the Houthis are being held back, and that Iran is thinking about what happens if it has to go up the escalation ladder. So if you imagine that, I mean, one scenario is that Donald Trump goes ahead and levels Karg.
Sorry?
Goes after Karg and Karg Island.
Sorry.
So, I mean, that decimates Iran's capacity to produce, to main source of income. So what Iran needs to be able to deter that is missiles. So the Houthis can be viewed as part of like a broader, possibly a broader plan. No, Iran has not used cruise missiles. It's possible that the U.S. got those cruise missiles or Israel got the cruise missiles. It unlikely got all of them. So Iran is in a position where it could escalate using those against its Arab neighbors. Saudi Arabia has been pretty much, you know, untargeted thus far, relatively speaking. So one question is whether that's being held. These kinds of things are being held back because they recognize the U.S. has a place where it can go. And, you know, Donald Trump, just maybe just for the record, has had Karg Island on his brain since 1988. That's the first time that he actually said Karg Island should be taken out. That was the problem with the previous American presidents, is they weren't playing tough with the Iranians.
Okay. I'll take three from the top. So one there, you, yes, and then one there, yes.
Sorry. Hello, good evening. Elena Cavniallo, board member in private equities and lecturer at the LSE. Let's assume that this U.S. administration has a well-thought strategy and gave a big assist to Mr. Putin to win over Ukraine, and now he's blackmailing over gas with the Europeans. So that was one reason for this attack. And the other question is about the resignation of Joe Kent today, which is something that speaks for itself. And then it will be Nowruz in 2 days, on Friday and Saturday, which is the biggest New Year's Eve for the Persian people. So it will be a big moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So there's, thank you. So,
hello, I'm a graduate from LSE, and my question is, what happened next? Israel say Turkey could be next Iran. How do you think about that?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
I mean, what happened after this war, because Israel say Turkey could be next Iran?
Fighting between themselves.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Benedetta Morari, PhD candidate at the European Institute. If I understand correctly, you left with two different scenarios, at least Toby and Sanam. On one hand, a dominance of a divide and impera strategy by Israel and the U.S. in the Middle East. On the other, the complete Iranian unwillingness to come up with the same result as the 12-day war last year. If we take Peter's conclusions into account, which is kind of like this unwillingness of the U.S. to take no for an answer and complete disregard for its allies, economic interests in the Gulf, security interests in Asia and in Europe, how would this conclusion, kind of like this role of the U.S. and its different perceptions from its ally, impact these two scenarios, either in favor of one or the other, but also the broader U.S. standing within the international order after this decision? Thank you.
Thank you. Can I just briefly mention or respond to the mention of Turkey? It seems to me that there's a lot of speculation about the possibility of Turkey taking or filling gaps that Iran, a weakened Iran, would leave in the region. And to me, this is not convincing. They're so different in their kinds of interests, the kinds of interests they have pursued in the region. And ultimately, despite the tensions, Turkey, of course, is part of NATO. So there is a complexity there which is unique to the case of Turkey, even though one can still characterize it as a middle power, an emerging and an important middle power in the Middle East region. Now, clearly, with Turkey, we have the Kurdish element there, and Turkish government is concerned with the possibility of the Kurdish forces in Iran being helped against Tehran. I don't know to what extent they would be able or willing to play this game, the Kurds in Iran. I don't think so. But nevertheless, I think this colors, this issue of the Kurdish threat real or imagined, is the one that determines Turkish policy very much. So please, if you could, maybe Peter, you want to start?
Sure, I'll pick up the Kent resignation today. I mean, the story is still unfolding, but I think given the grounds on which he resigned, arguing that there was no proximate threat to justify the intervention, the attack, I think what it is likely to do is fuel, let's call it, anti-war sentiment on the far right, and specifically among kind of influencers who are already expressing a lot of reservations about what Trump has done and are very concerned that what he will do next, and he's clearly being advised in some quarters to put troops on the ground on the northern side of the Persian, to try to secure it, to prevent, you know, to open it back to tankers. I don't think, I mean, I think it's still early days whether this would, this kind of thing, if it led to further resignations, that's one thing. But if it doesn't, it's right now, if you look at opinion polls, I mean, look, Americans are not in favor of this war. But if you break it down by party and by different groups inside the Republican Party, Trump supporters are, surprisingly, I think, given what Trump campaigned on, are holding pretty firm here so far. But this kind of thing where you have people inside the administration hand-picked people, you know, who are supporters of America First and so forth, resigning, I think, you know, it's a potential problem for them going forward.
Thank you, Toby.
Yeah, it's a very good question about what this does to U.S. power, depending on the two scenarios and the outcomes. With spectacularly bad timing, I finished a chapter in the edited volume that Mick Cox has put together on U.S. foreign policy, my chapter on the Middle East, and much to the editor's discomfort, I argue that there was a great deal of continuity between Obama, Biden, and Trump. Yeah, to some extent, you could identify tensions between Israel and the United States. You could identify a strong alliance and underpinning of security guarantees until we get to the June war, and especially whatever we call this, the Ramadan war is the favoured, where the plausible deniability or the at arm's length support just disappears, and you have, there clearly is different interests, different tactical hopes, different mistakes. I think Israeli intelligence has clearly showed itself to be incredibly accurate in targeting leaders of both Hezbollah and the Iranians, whereas I think maybe Joe Kent and resignation indicates that the American intelligence is more divided or less accurate in terms of targeting. I don't know, but the point being that the United States has removed any ambiguity in its strategic support for Israel under Trump. So if we move through the rest of the Trump administration, I think it clearly, Peter's right, it's clearly a damning insight into weaponizing interdependence. But it's also, it certainly indicates, I take the point very much, America's ability to wage war a long, long way away from its borders. But this is unambiguously Trump's war, and it's not going as Trump planned. And it is indicating, much the same as Bush's war in Iraq, I don't want to compare the two too closely, because it indicates a completely different type of hubris and a different type of lack of strategic planning. Bush planned and planned and planned, he just had the wrong plans. Trump doesn't seem to have planned at all.
And has the wrong plan.
And so in this case, I think whether the problematic outcome of this war, whatever it is, haunts American foreign policy in the region beyond Trump is an interesting question. I think it's too early to tell. I think the damage done to American security guarantees, which I think Boitano and Peter were alluding to, was done during Trump's first term. The hubris towards Iran and Trump's failure to back it up. It's been done, ironically, in a completely different way, with Trump's overstating American power to change facts on the ground. Just on Turkey and the Kurds, yes. If I may. Of course, Turkey's in Iran, and that may be wishful thinking, claiming in some punditry in Israel that it is. But of course, if we look at the map, moving the security complex towards Europe, but also towards Syria, Iraq, and Turkey brings different dynamics into play. I think I didn't want to really talk about Iraq today because I didn't think it's central to this. But the dynamics are really interesting. I think again, there's overestimation. I think Iraqi politics always works primarily under their own logic, not under an external logic, whether that's American or Iranian, and they will continue to work under their own logic. But those Iranian allies who look like they're going to have a weakened patron, are going to have to further indigenize their own support bases and survive under their own means. And we've already seen before the Hashdashabi and the Iranian aligned militias were directly targeted by the US, we've already seen growing tensions between the militias, the Iraqi army and the Iraqi government. I suspect those will increase, but that doesn't mean that Iraqi politics have somehow been transformed by the weakening of its neighbor, Iran. I think Iraqi politics have their own center of gravity.
I'll try to be quick. To answer the question up there, there is no sort of, it's not mutually exclusive. The United States and Israel will certainly emerge from this war as militarily dominant, but it doesn't mean that a weakened Iran can't try to influence the outcome in its favor. I think that's what's important to understand, and that's the sort of dynamic here, that an asymmetrical power that is being weakened day in, day out, still has some assets, even at a low level, that can impact costs horizontally, and we're seeing that with the Strait of Hormuz and the attacks on the Gulf and beyond. I think it's the implication here that we have to try to understand and digest. First of all, on the question of Turkey and then, you know, broadening it to the Kurds, I think that's where thinking about the planning and the known unknowns of this war very much matter. If the United States had planned for the known unknowns of this war, to use Rumsfeld's logic, obviously you would have thought of supporting opposition and not trying to belatedly, I don't know, mobilize Iranian Kurds to go and the consequence of that sort of disruptive behavior in Turkey or in Syria or in Iraq itself is certainly a reflection of, again, the lack of planning, and it speaks to Joe Camp, but more broadly, the intelligence agency in the United States that is clearly leaking every day what it has advised the U.S. president, that this would be a longer war, that the regime would come out hardened, that certainly supporting the Kurds is not a good idea. So I think we're getting a little bit of an insight in terms of the interfactional views within the U.S. administration or bureaucracy, for that matter. But, you know, to speak briefly on Israel, I think this is what I think I'd like to highlight. Israel is, without a doubt, got the quantitative military edge in the region, and I think we're sort of trying to say that Israel is no doubt demonstrating its capabilities in multiple frontiers across the region. But what Israel misses out of these conflicts and its ability to exert damage across the region is translating its military dominance into political settlements and processes that can also benefit Israel in the region. Israel will emerge from this war 100% further isolated and marginalized. And the reality is that the Israeli leadership are not digesting this. They are seeing their ability to mow the lawn as successful, their ability to redress their security strategy as important. And there's whole-scale alignment across the Israeli political establishment in support of this strategy, which is great for Israel. But if it thinks that it's going to emerge from this war returning to the status quo ante of normalization, that's where the buck has to sort of stop. Because for the region, for Arab states, for their economies, for their security architecture, there has been a sort of appreciation that Israel's military success is also destabilizing across the Gulf. And last year, of course, Qatar bore the price of that, being struck by Iran after the 12-day war and then also being hit on September 8th. So there will be a reprocessing. We just don't know how that reprocessing will develop.
And also, if I may interject, what is the internal situation within Israel going to develop as? Is there going to be fracture at some point following the present-day unity with regards to the military objective? I don't know if you have a sense of that. It is engaging in futurology to an extent.
Yes, I mean, you know, we can sort of anticipate that there is, you know, broad-scale alignment along the political spectrum in support of this war, because obviously Iran is a longtime adversary and one that is Prime Minister Netanyahu has sort of for 20 years supported as the primary adversary for Israel. I think what's going to be interesting is when the war ends, how this is going to impact the electoral dynamics in Israel. If there is a boost from this war, Israel will go to elections, and this will perhaps lead to the re-election of Prime Minister Netanyahu, or maybe some sort of realignment. And, you know, that will be important to watch in this year. I think more broadly, and this is what is missed in this war, and this is what's missed in all of these wars, the impact of this war in the other conflicts in the region. There's a second front that is open on in Lebanon with expectation that Israel is going to pile in militarily, try to take a buffer zone, and that will have devastating consequences for Lebanese, where, you know, hundreds of thousands have been displaced. And let's not forget Gaza and the West Bank. There is much happening in both of those domains while we are not looking.
Okay. I'm going to take two and two all together, so hopefully we can fit everything in by 8 o'clock. Okay, so one there. Yes. And you. Yes. And then I'll take one there and one there. Yes. Please introduce yourself.
So my name is Lukasz, former student at Birkbeck University of London. I have a question to Professor Trubowicz on the internal process of decision-making at Security Council. Obviously, the decision was made by Commander-in-Chief, President Trump, but to what extent we can see this as a breakdown of security decision-making process?
Within the U.S.
Within the U.S., yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And specifically Marco Rubio's influence, given his dual job of Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, or to put it in different terms, to what extent this can be seen as a feature of this administration, or rather a bug of decision-making process.
Thank you. Yes.
My name is Alan Elkadi. I work for an NGO in Palestine. I'm interested, and some of you touched on it, on how you think the change in America towards the support for Israel, the money being spent on the war, and some of the influences that you mentioned, how much the impact that will have on, first of all, Donald Trump and being in his situation, how he might react to that. But more importantly, how do you see that playing out with the relationship with in the States for the support for Israel in the long term?
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Yes.
I'm Shayan Chujayi. I'm studying international relations here in LSE. My question is about the domestic politics of Iran, because we know even though the Iranians would survive this conflict, what's the next? Because the economics is in the free fall. There is a mass unpopularity between people, and many leaders have been terrored, assassinated. So what are their plans? Because it's a really complex situation. I don't think so they can convince any more people for continuation of these policies, foreign policies and domestic policies. So I think they're in a very precarious situation. But do they have any plan, or do they have any strategy for after the war?
Thank you so much. Yes.
Hello, I'm James from the Syria-Britain Business Council. I was wondering, given that Syria at a stage of rebuilding, restructuring their institutions and rebuilding international partners, if given the fact that they might not be able to rely on the US for a security partnership or economic partnership for that matter, can you see Syria being closer to getting closer to the UK or Europe? And also, if I might add, what does this mean for, what does the situation or everything you've discussed mean for the Iraqi elections? Thank you.
Thank you. Your first question was about Syria, yes?
Yes, first question.
Thank you. Yes. Okay, very quickly on Donald Trump and Israel. I mean, there have been shifts over the past few years within the U.S. electorate in unprecedented ways with regards to support for Israel that started during the Biden administration, and it's, you know, manifesting in polling where there is just greater skepticism among the United States about the relationship. And actually, I think the Israelis are very aware of this. So how this develops, we'll have to see in terms of future elections, be it in November or beyond. But the enduring relationship, while enduring, is going through its challenges. And, you know, you can also see that reflected in Israel, as even Prime Minister Netanyahu quite recently suggested that over a 10-year period, Israel should seek greater autonomy in terms of defense from the United States itself. So very aware that the dynamics are shifting. I don't know what this means in the immediate outcome, but we should keep track of it because I think it will bear fruit. And Cheyenne, I want to answer your question and then I will leave it there. I think it's an important one to think about what comes next inside Iran. You know, honestly, it's the fog of war, so we don't really know. But the Islamic Republic came to this war prepared. They came to this war prepared because they knew decapitation was the objective of the Israelis and the Americans. And I think that there will be certainly further decapitations beyond what we've even seen today. Inside Iran, there have been a lot of hypotheses as to what comes next. And I personally think, like many of my colleagues, that obviously the Islamic Republic will rebrand as much more of a militaristic, perhaps nationalistic system. It will no doubt be weakened by this war and much more inwardly focused. But the impact of this will be borne by Iranians. I certainly think protests will be endemic in you know, the day after for Iran. Why? Because obviously the governance dynamics will be unchanged, if not more constrained. It's hard to see meaningful sanctions relief delivered for Iranians, although that's what the regime or what remains of it is seeking. But, you know, ultimately, without a more inclusive political system and process, I see protests as just a matter of time. It's hard to predict as to when they will occur, but certainly we know they will occur. So, yeah, that's as much as I can say. We'll just have to wait and see how the regime reconstitutes and rebuilds. But this is a new phase. This is the third republic of the Islamic Republic.
Thank you so much. Toby.
Yeah, thanks for the questions on Syria and Iraq. I think given the background and history of the new ruling elite in Damascus, I think they've had either they've proved to be remarkably astute in their diplomacy or they've had a good run of luck, especially given, as I mentioned earlier, the Israelis hitting their what was left of the state's navy and a lot of its army and what should we say, encouraging secessionist dynamics. But the U.S. is famously narrow in its decision-making and its attention span under this present administration, and the lifeblood of its foreign policy that had momentarily blessed a new regime in Damascus with its approval is being drawn towards the Gulf. The Gulf itself, as a natural vehicle for investment, is declining. Because its attention is elsewhere, I think you're right. I think to focus on the EU, the EU has a longer attention span and a much more powerful awareness of the backwash that a regime collapse in Syria, not that it looks likely at the moment, but it's certainly possible, could bring. So I agree with you there. And your own organisation has done sterling work in keeping the Syria issue and British businesses engaged. But on Iraq, as you know, the election took place as the system worked, which meant that the results were fractured. It's dominated by the coordination framework, and out pops that for various internal machinations, the premiership of Nouri al-Maliki. This is where some controversy arrives, that it was squashed by Trump tweets after the embassy made it very clear that it wouldn't be welcome. That, I suspect, was the outcome that was orchestrated by the sitting Prime Minister Sudani. But it leaves the progression to a premiership open, just as Iraq gets catapulted, if not into the centre, then at least the near edges of the regional conflict. So I suspect that'll be put on hold, which benefits the incumbent Prime Minister and his strategy of staying in power long enough to stay in power for another term. But I think At the moment, before last night, the Iraqi government had held up pretty well and had mediated the competing dynamics. If that, the longer, again, like everything else, the longer the war goes on, the more backwash across the Iranian border in. But I think the ruling elite is given regime change in Syria, potential regime collapse in Iran, the various groups that make up the Iraqi government are powerfully aware and to date are being fairly cautious about their own transition to a new government. So again, in a region that's in the middle of a externally driven conflict, that before last night at least, the Iraqi end of that conflict was by far not the worst.
Yes.
So first a comment about on the question about support, domestic support for Israel in the United States. I think basically what one could say over the past few years, it has declined considerably. At first on the left, but now I think the interesting dynamic is on the right. And you can see it among the influencers, you know, on social media, who are very concerned about the war, who believe that, you know, Donald Trump is carrying Netanyahu's border in this war, that he was kind of sent in there. They focus on Rubio's comments and so forth that seem to support that interpretation. You know, if you look at the polls right now, and there's a recent one that just came out and it was written up, it was a good piece by Ron Brownstein, who's now used to be a columnist for the Washington Post, before that the LA Times, and is now with CNN, who kind of documents it. It's out this week, and it's a very, very good piece on this. And so in a way, Netanyahu's strategy, it may be working, and so to speak, in the region, but it's not working very well in the United States. On the decision-making process, I would say it's a feature, it's not a bug. Basically, I think what's happened is that the decision-making process has been streamlined in the U.S., that is, in the White House. The intelligence agencies, the State Department, the NSC itself has been depopulated. So this is Elon Musk and beyond. So there are just many people that have lost their jobs, and so you don't have the same level of capacity that you had before. And then I think it's just important to say here that Donald Trump does not like people who give him bad news, that tell him what he does not want to hear. And you know, I mean, an interesting story that was out either today or yesterday is that the Joint Chiefs are now, what they're doing is the way they try to give him the bad news is to fold it into the strategic plans going forward where the off-ramps are, so that, you know, that to help them try to steer them in that direction. But you do not have, I think this is what I was saying, what I closed with in my opening comments, is he does not have people around him who are prepared to deliver bad news, to tell him this is the wrong way to go. Go this way. I mean, and I don't understand. If you're the president, what you actually should want is people around you who basically got your back by telling you, don't do this, it's going to backfire. So I think he's gotten too much positive reinforcement. I don't think the planners explain why he's done what he's done. There are other reasons. They're political. They have to do with the way he saw Venezuela was, just like a hot knife through butter. He's got plenty of domestic reasons for not wanting to focus on problems at home, but to focus on international issues. So they think he's been redirected by ICE, by Epstein, the Epstein files, and also by the issue of affordability. And the final thing is he saw what was presented to him
at a critical moment was intelligence, where all these Iranian leaders were in one of two or two places. It was like a perfect moment, you know, in a sense, an exquisite moment, as they say, in intelligence. So I think there's like all these other considerations, but what there's not is a set of a broad kind of deliberation, I think, that is taking place inside the administration. And of course, none of this is vetted in Congress.
Thank you. As chair, my task is to end this on a positive note. Now, I can't think of a positive note, but I will say that history has taught us that even the worst, most conflict-ridden parts of the world have at some point reached peace. And we can hope, I think, for the Middle East as well. One day it will happen, I'm sure. Thank you all very much, and thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.